I have some preliminary comments to make, and then we'll move into the purpose, which is sort of to eulogize the hall of that wonderful chapter in Cambridge. I just came from a session where we were being chastised as Sunstone directors for certain things that we need to do better. And one of them is, someone commented, Ron Fredrickson, who is a professor of theater and of presentations like this, he said, you gotta get people using the microphone right, he said. And he went on to comment about last night where the second speaker, hardly anybody could hear her, and it was because she wasn't speaking in the microphone. And he said, so I will direct comment to all of you here today that at least for this session, that you're supposed to get yourself in one of this kind of microphone is about half an inch away from the mic when you talk. And you talk directly into it and speak loudly. So you can all hear me, can't you? All right. But anyway.
You can still get closer.
Well, I don't know. Not that much closer. Anyway, I'm very nostalgic about chapels. I once gave a ball presentation here at Sunstone about this tragedy, and it's an inevitable tragedy, but in the church we no longer build chapels by ourselves. We contract it out, and I think that's probably liability laws and things like that require it. But I think so fondly about the first four moves we made in our marriage was each time into a war that was just starting a building campaign, and then we went on to build a chapel. And it was in Boulder, Colorado, and then in Ithaca, New York, and then in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then in Walnut Creek, California. And those chapels where I got some blood, sweat and tears under those beams and that sort of thing, I have a personal invested interest in those things. Today, the cookie cutter chapter buildings that we build with the church, and it's inevitable we have to do it, but I don't really have any personal attachment to them. I just, the ones that I go to church and that's it. But now we get on to the Cambridge Chapel, which is unique in that respect. I didn't ever put any sweat and tears into building the thing. I got there when it was about 2 years old, 2 years after President McKay dedicated it. And I only spent 2 years there. There are people here who might just as well have been born there because of the amount of time that they spent there. But they will have a lot more to say about what went on there. But I identify with it even though I didn't help build it because of, I think, the unique architecture, its location, and then just all the wonderful things that happened there to those of us who it was a temporary home while we were going to graduate school. So we'll proceed with our presentation, and we'll start doing the order of the program. Samuel Brown, who's an assistant professor of pulmonary and clinical care, and he said he was there in the 90s, roughly, weren't you?
Yeah.
Okay, in the 90s. Then after that, I have Claudia Bushman, and I think she started out there in Wellesley when she was just a young whelp out of high school, didn't you? Was it Wellesley? Huh? Yeah, okay. And then she kept coming back, kind of like Bad Penny, that she went back there all in a lot of iterations. Phil Barlow will, if he makes it in here, he'll be the next speaker, and then Mary Webster, who I guess was that she's our today's generation in the generation 2000. So we'll go from there, and then I presume we're going to have time for comments from others who have an experience there and would like to share it. And so we'll go from there. And I didn't stay that close to it, but this is how we're supposed to do it.
So ideally, it works seamlessly, but we live in a fallen world. As my wife is one to remind me, I suspect because I remind her most proximately that it is a fallen world. That's a thought for another day. I will now approach the microphone cautiously and respectfully and
closely.
Closely.
The experimental psychologists and new atheists love to tease us about our memories. Memory, they tell us gleefully, is an easily manipulable collection of sensations stored in a million strange ways in the brain. It is, in many respects, a figment of our imagination. They gesture, the spittle of earnest superiority streaming from their lips towards smudgy maps of the brain. Astonishing, they tell us, that there's nothing more to us than that, a fatty lump of organic wires intermittently shorting their circuits. As you may suspect, I dissent sharply from such a philistine and materialist view. To this atheist view, I would counterpose the luminous first paragraphs of Vladimir Nabokov's memoir, Speak Memory. I quote, "The cradle rocks above an abyss, and common sense tells us that our existence is but a brief crack of light between two eternities of darkness. Although the two are identical twins, man, as a rule, views the prenatal abyss with more calm than the one he is heading for at some 4,500 heartbeats an hour. First and last things often tend to have an adolescent note. Nature expects a full-grown man to accept the two black voids, fore and aft, as stolidly as he accepts the extraordinary visions in between. Over and over again, my mind has made colossal efforts to distinguish the faintest of personal glimmers in the impersonal darkness on both sides of my life. I have journeyed back in thought, with thought hopelessly tapering off as I went, to remote regions where I grope for some secret outlet, only to discover that the prison of time is spherical and without exits. Short of suicide, I have tried everything. In probing my childhood, which is the next best to probing one's eternity, I see the awakening consciousness as a series of spaced flashes, with the interval between them gradually diminishing until bright blocks of perception are formed, affording memory a slippery hold." Nabokov's memoir, beautifully represented in this early passage, represents a prolonged study of the meaning of memory, the ways that memory, our intentional return to places and times we have once inhabited, has the capacity to transform us. Memory points to times before and after, yearns to stretch beyond them, displaces and distorts time. For me, as a Latter-day Saint, memory allows me to conceive the eternal persistence of my being. I believe that a memory is immensely particular, as are we, and so as I frame the meaning of the sacred space and time of the Cambridge Chapel, I will be rather specific. I'm grateful for a variety of very specific images of my slow approach to God through life. There are a pair of images from my childhood in Helena, Montana. Perhaps five or six men stand huddled around me. I lay prone, wrapped in a bright yellow blanket, though it is possible that my memory has imported that blanket from later in my childhood. My body burns and my brain aches. I remember the gently modulated fear of the voices of the elders my father had assembled to bless me, the knowing hush attending the words, Hong, Kong, flu. A physician now, I doubt there was ever a risk to me of more than brief misery, but the time I thought I might be hovering between the present world and the world to come. Perhaps 2 years later, I sat in that same dingy house on the poor side of Helena, being goaded into bearing a testimony I did not have of an ordinance baptism I did not want. My father, so frightened and alone through his entire brief life, believed that he could call from me the faith he so desperately wished would free him of his own mangled psyche. Against my will, I entered the waters of baptism, frightened, conflicted, and confused. Next, I remember how, as a still conflicted teen in Utah, I encountered the Uinta and Wasatch Mountains. There I learned to walk barefoot, to sample the strong and smooth needles of pines and firs. Oh, I was just trying to be... I was trying to be obedient and dutiful. Oh, that's fine. I don't know how to run microphones, I'll confess. You think this is it?
Just back off from it.
Back off from it.
Yeah, we have a problem, just the opposite of yesterday. The person in this one was okay. So loud when I was here.
Turns out I'm a loud gentleman. Is this good enough? Should we just get rid of the microphone?
But we won't get your comments.
No, I think the microphone will pick up my loud voice, even if I'm not right with it. To sample the potent fragrance of forest duff in its delicate balance of living and dying. More than anything, I love the alpine lakes of the Hayuinas, places we reached after arduous walks, and the meadows. I had a picture of a lake in earlier, and I lost it. Perched atop glacial boulders in varying stages of Edenic undress, reading or writing poetry, swimming in pure lakes, building rafts from felled trees that barely kept our chests above water. In those sacred precincts, an agnostic teen began to believe that there might be a reason to suspect and even relish the existence of a creator. Third, I remember that within the comparative civilization of 1980s Davis County, in the town of Kaysville, there is a dirty hill, the wall of a small gorge on the south side of town. I sit astride a Yamaha two-stroke motorcycle borrowed for the weekend from a friend. I have told God in the logic that only makes sense in youth or deep sadness that I will believe in his existence and turn away from my agnostic dissolution if I can crest that 20-foot hill. A modern and impetuous Sisyphus, I drop the motorcycle each time with more than 5 feet left before the short side cornice at the top. After perhaps 15 attempts, I declared God to be in default on our bargain and ride the motorcycle home, where I spend the evening staring at a paperback Book of Mormon. The next day, I am kneeling beside a simple altar, the type of formica burnished table that must have seemed practical and cheap when my church house was built decades before my birth. There is my bishop, now just dead from myeloma, sitting on the rostrum, his broken thumb fingering a black binder, my mother lost in thought on a pew amidst many loud children, my closest friends and my younger brother beside me. As I call out God the Eternal Father, there is a holy and entirely overwhelming rush of the Spirit, the mystical or numinous experience that has been treasured for millennia. I am reborn, my knee against cheap, knotty carpet, my hand clasping a laminated index card with the words of our sacramental prayer. This is an experience I have never had again, a magnificent penetration of the dark abysses flanking my existence, but it is one that I have periodically recalled to keep me spiritually alive, to keep me Mormon. Perhaps a month later, I received the priesthood of Melchizedek, the sacramental essence that Joseph Smith announced would save everyone in the world by uniting them in love and hope and aspiration and commitment. The only visual image from that life-changing summer that a camera stored for me depicts me in the midst of people I love, my mind far away. Just this year, I returned to that very room to bid farewell to the old friend and bishop who had shepherded my return to belief and behavior. It was a painful jolt, that premature end in a room of beginnings, as this friend had moved to the latter abyss, where I had left a sort of former abyss. These places remember, and they cause to remember. A month after my conversion at that sacrament altar, I arrived in Boston to start college, a long-haired Jesus freak who wanted to read books and minister to those in need. The Longfellow Chapel immediately became the central feature of the environment of my belief. As I search my memories of nearly two decades ago, the first and most prominent is of the ward dinner in the early 1990s. Every week we converted our cultural hall, which always seemed a better term for someone as inathletic as I, into a shared dining space that made our Sunday meal in the Longfellow Chapel half soup kitchen and half ward dinner, the hungry and marginalized mingling with aspiring Mormon intellectuals and ambitious students and professionals in that gymnasium. I remember Michael with his learning disability and a sharply hooked nose, his temporary home in the basement of the Congregational Church two blocks from ours. I stole food for him and his friends from the college cafeteria, volunteered, smuggled it out in a pillowcase I've just remembered, filled with fruit and sandwiches.
They didn't arrest me, but they did indicate that I would need to stop if I intended to continue in college. Volunteered at the shelter in the Congregational Church. Walked with him, heard his stories, listened to his terrible keyboarding on a Casio that bleated uncertainly under the pressure of his large fingers. Because of the Longfellow Chapel, I was able to meet Michael as a person rather than a representative of homelessness. I assumed he was a church member for several weeks until he confessed with embarrassment that he was not Mormon and that he lived in the basement of a Congregational Church. Through the power of the community that church allowed us to create, Michael and I created a friendship that extended through my mission and beyond. That building also contained the sacrament hall with its oval window, glowing with the stippled light from shimmering trees that reminded me of nothing so much as a gentle breeze through a stand of quaking aspen on a bright afternoon high in the Uintas. There I heard stories of faith and uncertainty, of commitment and disaffection, of loves requited and unrequited, of emotions and attachments that obeyed and disobeyed conscience and tradition. More than anything, I remember the sense that all of us were saints, that in the silent reaches of that church, which watched and contained, but did not require a particular view, we were a community, a created family of sacred durability. Nabokov was right that the flashes of inspiration come best in adolescence or young adulthood, that state between the big before and the big after. And the Longfellow Park Chapel is where I grew into a Latter-day Saint. These sacred spaces, the Uinta Mountains, a chapel in Kaysville, Utah, and the Longfellow Park Chapel, have marked three different, interdependent phases in my growth as a believer and a child of God. In the Uintas, I learned to feel gratitude and clarity. In Kaysville, I first encountered what scholars call the numinous, or the mysterium tremendum at Fascinans. In Cambridge, at that red brick chapel that saw several generations of aspirations and belief, I encountered community, the sort of rough and tumble, many square pegs and many more round holes, community that can give us hints of what Zion might look like. There I felt perfectly equal in the most relevant sense with everyone, with people whose lives were filled with music or numbers or books or the drudgeries of secretarial works, or the sudden and uncertain pleasures of nurturing a stranger's children. Or, and this is something that continues to amuse me, with people whose minds were filled with robots and spaceships. In that hidden space within the Northeast, that enclave of Mormonism in the land of the Mathers, and then Emerson, and then the abolitionists, and then Chomsky and Howard Zinn, we came together as a community. These spaces that hold memories, and Clayton Christensen, who was the bishop there when I arrived, ever efficient, described the chapel as a filing cabinet for memories. But these spaces that contain the memories, I might not use the same business metaphor, exert some of their great power in part because of their neutrality. Able to be experienced by many different people, to have created within them a wide variety of mental and spiritual worlds, these spaces allow us to create community precisely because they mean different things to different people. Rather than worrying with the postmodernists about the multiplicity of meaning lurking behind each symbol, in my experience, I am nourished to speak and hear proclamations of love for a place that also I have loved. These holy places hold our memories, provide an architecture and container for them. It is this process of creating memories, of building character, to borrow the language of self-improvement and stern piety, that builds our spiritual identity. Because 3 years ago I decided to return to the sacred spaces of the Uintas and the Wasatch, I felt with particular misery the loss of that chapel, my schoolhouse of Zion, as the memories had lost their container.
I hope you can hear me. I was present when the Cambridge Chapel was dedicated. I sat about 4 feet away from President David O. McKay, who came out to speak. I remember the date because I was very pregnant with my first child, Clarissa, There had been some doubt that I would make it to the dedication at all because Clarissa was due on October 1st, but she was not born until October 3rd, and I was there, a member of the dedication choir. We sang "How Lovely Is Thy Dwelling Place" from the Brahms Requiem and the Hosanna Anthem. So the birth of the building is closely allied to the birth of my first child. I became a mother there. But I have detailed memories that precede the dedication of that chapel. When I began as a freshman at Wellesley College in 1952, I called the mission office and asked for directions to the chapel, an aged, dark, Longfellow house on the same location. I was quite scornful of the missionaries who were unable to provide a clear and concise direction on how to get there. What were they there for if not to tell us how to get to church? But I discovered why they couldn't give good directions after traveling, transferring twice, finally coming in on the long-gone Mount Auburn streetcar and walking up through a very scruffy Longfellow Park. It was a long and complicated journey. The first day I was incensed and grumpy. When I finally met some of the other college students, my question was, why did the church buy property in a slum like this? Not a very nice thing to say when the church had sacrificed to buy two spacious and significant houses on Cambridge's finest thoroughfare, Brattle Street. But after growing up in beautiful San Francisco, with its emphasis on the new, the beautiful, and the fashionable, I found Boston drab, frumpy, full of treasures, but too sure of herself to show them off. Boston and Cambridge are much better looking now than they were then. But still, it was insulting and jejune for a brash Westerner to say such things of the glorious city that we all came to love. Still, that snide comment came to my great benefit that year as a Harvard sophomore, Gar Cranny, whose wonderful and long-lived mother only recently came to the end of her productive and virtuous life in Belmont, decided to take me on as a distant lost cause. He decided to educate me about the glories of Cambridge and Boston. Once a week, he would come to Wellesley to pick me up. Then on the 12-mile ride back to town, he would lecture me about some magnificent site that we were about to visit. Today, we are going to the Saugus Ironworks, and this is important because we're going to see the Christian Science Mother Church in the Maparian. The Cooper Frost Austin House is the oldest house in Cambridge, built in. He worked very hard on his presentations, learned a few things himself, and so on. After a while, I began to take him to concerts and art museums and tell him why they were important. And as a result of this activity of students teaching each other, we became very close friends and both became better informed, and I certainly became much more appreciative of Boston. When I first came to church in Cambridge, we met only on the morning for Sunday school. The trip in took longer than the service. This difficulty was alleviated when I discovered that Claire and Rulin Robeson, longtime church pillars, brought in the Wellesley girls to church. Rulin, a teacher of voice, conducted a rousing and informative song practice. I remember his rehearsals very well. He commented that our congregation never learned anything and started from scratch every week. Soon after my arrival, the ward instituted an evening sacrament meeting of the old style. The Robesons still came in and then went home after the morning meeting, but I wanted to stay for the later evening meeting as well. This meant I was soon lunching and museum going with one male student or another, because, for one thing, I frequently forgot to bring car fare and lunch money and had to charm somebody into taking me to lunch and then getting someone to get a car to drive me back home to Wellesley. But this is what girls were used to in the old days. I expected it, and it happened. I do remember how shocked I was after attending a formal dance at a Harvard house, and I watched a girl and her date stroll out of the hall. He kissed her goodnight, she unlocked her bicycle, tucked up her taffeta skirt, and rode away to Radcliffe. We Wellesley girls would never have put up with a thing like that. And I am still shocked shot. I was surprised when Ira Terry, the branch president, called me in that first year. He said he had gotten a letter about me. Amazing. It seemed that my lively grandmother feared the worst about me, that I had disappeared from view, as so many young Mormons did, on going to another big city. She urged him in the letter to find me and put some pressure on me to come to church. The letter even had a threatening tone. He had better get busy and do it. President Terry urged me just as strongly to write to my grandmother and tell her that I was very active in the church. I know it doesn't always happen, but I've watched with interest as many young people, supposedly fleeing from Zion, become more religious in Cambridge, decide to go on missions and get married in the temple. Meanwhile, the young people from Cambridge go west to BYU, they get bored, alienated, and sometimes get into trouble. This is all anecdotal evidence, but I think we should do a study. A related phenomenon was when I experienced each year in September, as the new wives came to town and at testimony meetings, in tears, told how sorry they were to be away from their mothers, their wards, and Zion. Then in June, another group of wives and mothers would stand to weep and say how much they regretted having to leave Cambridge, which they had come to love so deeply. We should do a study about that as well. I love coming to church here with its variety of interesting people of all ages. I particularly like teaching junior Sunday school, which I was soon called to do. Wellesley was a paradise, no question, but it was occupied only by girls 18 to 22, along with a few desiccated professors and administrators. I, who had been very active in church, but also very casual about it, marked Sunday as my church day, spent the day going to church and, of course, engaging in social activities. At college, I stopped doing any work on Sunday. At the same time, I became a better church person. I also became a more serious student. It was much longer before I became a really serious student, and I doubt I am really one yet, but the seeds were planted then. The student group in our day was very small and tight. People told me right away about all the other students who were around that I had not yet seen. Chase Peterson, the senior member of the LDS students in Boston, having been to prep school, to Harvard College and about to attend Harvard Medical School, was widely admired. I was told with hushed awe that he was in the infirmary with the mumps. For some reason, I joined a group that went to see him there, eager to see this heroic paragon. But there he was, in flannel pajamas, suffering from a childhood illness, not in his most imposing and impressive style. I was, however, impressed at how stylish and nonchalant he could be, even as an invalid. Richard Bushman, another important absent student, was off on a mission to the New England States, headquarters in another old house next door to the old house where we had church. I guess that people in the Salt Lake Missionary Office thought that he had learned the language and would be able to communicate with and convert the locals. He had told his Harvard friends that he would be going to some exotic clime to preach the gospel and was somewhat crestfallen to have to admit that he was only moving next door, as it were. He drove around New England checking on the missionaries from Connecticut to Nova Scotia, all by himself, as missionaries were in short supply during the Korean War. When he came to Cambridge, his mission president, J. Howard Mon, who always called him Dick, warned him to stay away from his old friends. But somehow, he turned up one time at an after-church gathering in the room of one of his old friends. I happened to be there, and we met, beginning a relationship that bloomed after his return to school. I was here there when we began many of the projects to raise money to build the new chapel. How could that ever be done? We were a poor bunch, nothing like current times. We had ward suppers, we made small individual donations, we had some way to make money with stockings, Betty Hinckley had the Relief Society making purse inserts for some dollars. George Albert Smith Jr., who taught at the Harvard Business School, our most established and successful member, wrote to all his friends and former members of the branch and asked for contributions. Did we have to furnish 50% then? It was a lot of money. I thought there was no way that we could ever raise enough money. But suddenly it was time to build. The locals were not pleased at the upstart Mormons who were building on Brattle Street. Mark Cannon, one of the guys of the old days, told me just last year that McGeorge Bundy, then a Harvard dean, had told him how much he enjoyed seeing the disappointment of some of his Cambridge friends at their inability to prevent the spoiling of the neighborhood by the Mormons getting established in their new chapel. He believed that their unhappiness was very much deserved as a result of their negative attitude. But then McGeorge Bundy was a serious politician, as some of us remember, and he was talking to Mark. In a more positive version of the same kind of comment, I remember George Albert Smith saying that a friend looking at the plans suggested that the Brattle Street facade enclosing the cultural hall looked pretty institutional, even penal, and suggested that it be broken up with some windows or other architectural devices. Some compromises were made, and I certainly hope that the rebuilt building, there will be more compromises and a little less threatening facade. Bill Cox was a very potent force in policing the building of the chapel. He came every night to see that any slipshod work that was done that day had to be torn out and replaced the next day. Cox reconverted himself to the church by the building construction and went on to become branch president, a mission president, and later president of the Manchai Temple, where he was single-handedly, according to my sources, where he single-handedly prevented the modernization of that august building. He was one of the category of irascible saint common in Mormonism. I'm going to skip some parts of this, even though they're the best parts. Richard had come to Cambridge in 1949. I came in 1952. We left together in 1960. There's a great deal more that happened there, but I am just going to finish at this point and say, our heritage from living in Cambridge is incalculable. I think that all of us are different than we would have been from having had this experience. I certainly have. We share rich memories and a sense of initiation that others lack. How lucky we are to have this rich gift in our lives. Maybe we should do a study about that.
Okay, thank you so much. Sorry to barge in here late. I was detained. The great Yale historian Sidney Ahlstrom won the Booker Award in the early 1970s for a book called Religious History of the American People. And that remains, in my judgment, though intellectual historical trends come and go, that remains the most magisterial and complete treatment of religion in America by a single author in a single work. And in this great magisterial historical treatment, he gives the Mormons 10 very, very thoughtful pages. And he concludes these, and that's a lot of room in a book like that, where you're trying to cover the religious history of the American people. And he concludes these thoughtful 10 pages with this statement, this phrase: with attractive edifices on Brattle Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and in many other cities and suburbs across America, the Mormons, ... and then he concludes his thought. I thought that was a charming way, perhaps colored by his New Haven environs of writing his history, to sum up the Mormons with attractive edifices on Brattle Street and elsewhere in America. That may be a little bit grand for this building that we're honoring and remembering, considering today. But on the other hand, I wondered for a while, a few days ago, when thinking what I might say here upon Sam's invitation, why anyone would care about the Longfellow Chapel if they hadn't been there. And the answer probably is they wouldn't. Those few of you in the room probably have some connection or another to the chapel by and large. So that prompted me to think about the meaning of the chapel to different constituents. And I went online to see how others reflected about this fire and about the meaning of this building. One curious piece I came across was the Washington Post treated the fire in May of this year, and they gave it a few paragraphs, and juxtaposed to their few paragraphs about, what was their headline, if I have it, "Fire During Services Guts Decades-Old Massachusetts Church." But juxtaposed to this short several paragraphs in the Washington Post was a large picture of 14 people, 7 couples. And the caption underneath this photograph that seemed oddly to go with the Cambridge Chapel fire was this: "Gay couples who brought the landmark lawsuit that led to the first legalized gay marriages in the United States pose for a photo during a reunion in Newton, Massachusetts, Sunday, May 17th. They were celebrating their 5th anniversaries of being married. So for the Washington Post, the fire that destroyed the Longfellow Chapel was an opportunity for political football to link this is fire, it's about Latter-day Saints, gays, and so they went that way with it. And I could give you, if we had more time, other such examples. So the meaning of this fire is not obvious for everybody. For other people, this building is a place of public historical fame, for Latter-day Saints at least, sort of like going to Plymouth Rock for Americans. This, decades before the chapel was built, this is where John Widsoe proposed to Leah. This is where Levi Edgar Young negotiated the prize for. So there's that sort of purpose, but the chapel and its demise has been put to that sort of purpose. I think that the building and all sacred space can be a prompt for more serious considerations. Particularly, it helps if we think about what religion is, and that's a contentious and difficult grapple. Many people who have tried to craft a definition of religion can't concur about it. One of my favorite definitions, however, for a full-blown religion, not a religion of one, what Philip Barlow believes or Betty Johnson believes, which is common in America, but a full-blown, full-developed religion, the scholar Kathy Albanese created a mnemonic of 4 C's for us to try to remember. She said a religion entails a creed, whether formally or informally, some sort of worldview and series of beliefs, a code, some sort of moral or ethical fabric to go along with the creed, a cultus, which is a technical Latin term for ritual and devotion, and community. Those are the essential components, she said, of religion. I like to add 3 more C's to what religion is. Religion entails a culture. As Jan Shipps is fond of saying, cults become cultures, so there are ways and byways. There is a call, that is some reason for the religion to become a religion, to come into existence, a story that goes along with it. And there are confines. That is, religion is practiced somewhere, and the somewhere takes on importance and is intrinsic to the religion. If the religion doesn't occur somewhere, it doesn't occur. So space, abstract space, becomes place with experience and with stories and with the other components of religion, particularly including community. Space and geography is intrinsic to religion, though we often get deaf to that or not very sensitive to it. It's related to why Moses and the burning bush in the story comes down to us with those particulars. The sacred grove for Joseph Smith comes down to us, the Exodus sacred land. It's why Muslims turn to Mecca 5 times a day or make pilgrimage once in their life. It's why Martin Luther remembered that it was on the privy in Wittenberg in 1512 where he was struck by the freeing words of Romans 1 and 17. I think that the Longfellow Chapel was New England Mormonism's synagogue, which literally means the gathering together place. And because it was a gathering together place, the gathering together place for several generations of truly uncommon Latter-day Saints, some of which have gone on to public fame, some of which most of us will never hear of, but it was an unusual meeting place of an unusual group. I could convey personal items of nostalgia to you at if you were my family around the hearthside and actually cared. I could go on at great length and have learned that my family doesn't always care about those things that are dear to me. Claudia Wilbur W. Cox was my mission president, so before I had any dream of going to Boston myself out in San Francisco and Oakland area, he used to regale us and regale me sometimes in his car with stories of Boston where I had never been. But Mitt Romney and John Udall and I, as the bishopric of one of the Cambridge wards, used to deliberate about the saints in the context of a very lively, fairly new feminism among the saints and other political forces, as many people in the ward grappled their way towards faith and responsible citizenship and intellectual integrity. Mitt, who was not naive to the ways of the world, was the governor's son and had been in a state presidency for the first several weeks, came to our meetings shaking his head and saying, "I had no idea that people lived this way." Here in this chapel, Chase Peterson brought time to a standstill for me one Sabbath in a sacrament meeting as he probed the mysterious wonder of the sacrament. Here on Tuesday night, basketball nights, I learned that Kim Clark had a more consistent jump shot than I. And I dreamt, I prayed to no avail that I would sometime be able to dunk the ball over Clayton Christensen. Here, Lynn Jacobson, partner and dupe of Mark Hoffman, would come each Tuesday night and play the organ like Bach on steroids so that the entire building shook, and then make his way up to my institute office on the second floor and coyly drop insinuations about salamanders and forthcoming passages from the lost manuscript pages of the Book of Mormon, or slip me a flawed page of an early Doctrine and Covenants that he and Hoffman had razored out and replaced with a more perfect one in order to increase their value. But instead of all those endless small anecdotes, let me just share two stories. One was of my failure in the Cambridge chapel that I hold with treasured, painful, scarred memory. And one is a story of what the Cambridge chapel was not, but the was not, is for me in relation to the Longfellow Chapel. I, for 2 years, locked up the chapel late at night while I was in graduate school. They gave me $100 a month. I'm sure I would have done it as a calling or a service, but I was desperate for money. They advertised it that way. I took them up on it. And so every night I locked up the chapel. Sometimes I had to do that very late because there was a Cambridge First Ward and a Cambridge Second Ward and a University Ward and a Spanish branch and the mission offices of the New England Mission and the Institute of Religion. It was a busy place, and I had to wait till everyone was out. Sometimes that meant at midnight or 1 a.m. And I lived next door to the chapel. You'll have to refresh me, Richard and Claudia, on the truth, because I wasn't there when it happened, but I think I was told that it was that building next door that was moved from the chapel side intact, mostly intact, and slid over so that the chapel could be built. And I thought I was very picturesque because I stayed in T.S. Eliot's guest room where he used to stay with the Hall family. And so I would have the pretense of reading Eliot while I stayed in Eliot's room in between buzzers downstairs when I would be called to buttle, as Sally Gordon taught me a word I didn't know, but I was the butler, so I buttled while I was in graduate school there. One night, late at night, since every time I checked, people were still in the building, so I went over at about midnight and checked all the doors in the chapel and lights. I found a young woman on the pew, and she was lying weeping softly. Her name was Lisa, and I tried to talk to her softly, and she wouldn't move. I touched her on the shoulder, and she said, "Leave me alone." And in my young, inexperienced state, I didn't know how to handle this. I sat for a few minutes in the pew and tried to talk to her a little bit, and all she could say was, "Leave me alone." And that didn't seem a very good option. So I said, "Lisa, can I call you a cab? Can I drive you somewhere? Can I take you home? I can't go home." I offered to take her next door, where my wife and I kept quarters upstairs. We could make an extra bed. Come here and sleep. "Leave me alone. I don't want to go." Finally, I said, and here was my error, I think, in retrospect, "Lisa, you can't stay here." And before I could do anything else, she jumped up, she ran out of the chapel and out through the foyer, and I said, "Lisa," and she said, "Leave me alone," and ran out into the night. A better option may have been going to get her a blanket and me sleeping in the foyer or something till dawn, and I figured something else better. Did I make sacred space unsacred, or did I desecrate holy space by my clumsiness and not extending the shelter of the Cambridge Chapel to her? Second story. I wrote a journal account and later published it in an essay. Let me read you three paragraphs before I quit. Across the street from what was once my office in Cambridge at the Longfellow Chapel lies the campus of the Episcopal Divinity School. On this campus, discreetly placed behind the chapel, kneels a life-sized statue. By all appearances, he has knelt there a great while. His head is raised, his back is arched, his palms are lifted to his face, perhaps stopping tears. His posture is one of profound despair. The statue has occasionally been my companion. I have spent hours alone with him, responding to or identifying with him. He remains unnamed to the best of my knowledge, so I call him Anguish. To me, he means the abyss of not knowing, or the agony of personal or global sin. He means fear. He means participation in estrangement and unjustified suffering, comprehension of the human condition. My brother, more observant than I, once pointed out to me that did the statue's hand not obscure his eyes, he might be staring at the cross on the pinnacle of the steeple high above him. Perhaps then he also means compassion for the suffering Christ, compassion suffering, signifying not merely suffering with or pity, but sympathy for. I have considered the odds of such a troubled statue finding a home on Temple Square or on some other distinctly Mormon ground like the Longfellow Chapel. The prospect seems unlikely. I do not mean a look how much the pioneers suffered for us statue. We have that kind already, and they are important tributes to valiant people. But I mean art that reflects my stake in the universal plight of the race. It's hardly surprising that our public places house no such art, for Mormonism is an optimistic and proselytizing faith, and it desires appropriately to convey its optimism to others. Yet anguish is a part of my reality, and there are times, I wrote then, when where I most want to be is behind the chapel of the Episcopal Divinity School, or across the street worshiping in silence with my Quaker friends. So there are some things for my personal faith, as I expressed it then, that the Cambridge Chapel did not represent, but it always was tethered in a dialogue to the chapel and my community, and my faith was forged there in part. A young undergraduate friend of mine at Hanover College in Indiana, where I used to teach, taught me what I should have been taught in third grade, and that is that mathematics is not about numbers, it's about relations. In the years since, I've thought the same about religion. Whatever else it is about, it's about relations between me and me, between me and you, between me and God, between me and unbelievers, us and unbelievers. I always found my excursions to the Episcopal Divinity School or to the Quakers across the street to be a thing in helpful, constructive, faithful relation with my home base life at Longfellow Chapel. So I've always been grateful for it. I was deeply saddened to hear of this fire, of course, as were others of you in the room. But I found a redemptive picture that I like very much that maybe I could close with, if you could fire that up, Sam. One of my former institute students, then named Ruby Souza, took this picture. She says the story of how she happened to be there is very interesting, but I wasn't able to reach her by a cell phone. Another friend, Toma Hagen, got this from Ruby and shared it with some others of us. And to me, that image captures something of my broader faith in the world, in the gospel, in the ultimate okayness of things. Somehow, in the midst of all that devastation that could be the apocalypse at the end of the world, for all it symbolizes in my head, not just the space at the chapel, for all of the end of the world looking destruction, there is the redemption of the light of heaven shining out above the roof that is no longer there, and through the famous circled window that generations of saints have found cause to meditate on and find inspiration in. So at last, I don't see flames in my head when I think of missing the chapel. I see this. Thank you very much.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed what I've heard so far, and I don't have much to add. My name is Mary, and I was a member of the Longfellow Park Church, first and second wards, for 7 years. I moved here to Salt Lake just a year ago from the Longfellow Park ward, and I consider my time there to be, as I think all of us would feel who were there, quite life-changing. And while I don't have any formal prepared remarks, I hope you'll forgive me for that, I thought it would be better if I just shared some purely anecdotal and personal thoughts. I also asked some of my friends to who are still there, ask them for some of their thoughts and get some ideas of what's happening now, as they are taking care of the chapel now, getting rid of the wreckage and planning to rebuild. What's happened to the saints out there? What are they doing? I thought that might be of interest to someone. I want to start with a couple of light things. I can tell you that the spirit of community and of the blending of secular and spiritual education is alive and well. I was often intimidated by my gospel doctrine classes. I was there in Boston originally as a graduate student at the Boston Conservatory studying music. I was into show tunes, and it seemed that everyone else on the aisles and in the pews was doing something much more loftier with their lives and had a much more articulate way of expressing themselves, and I was often intimidated, and yet I came to understand and come into the knowledge of what I could contribute to a community like that, and found myself very much a part of a community of people that were diverse and interested in things that that I was not. But it also helped me become more interested in things that I never otherwise would have been. Almost from the first year I was there, the Longfellow Park Chapel was devoted almost entirely to singles wards. There were two university wards and two older singles wards called the Longfellow Park First and Second Wards. It quickly became a tradition, something they call Super Cute Sunday. And I'd like to speak to you a little bit about that. Super Cute Sunday was a phenomenon that started about the last Sunday in August, first Sunday in September, when the new blood was coming in. And so that meant that the guys got all gussied up and the women likewise. And it became quite the joke that everybody just did a little extra shopping trip that Sunday before. Something that some people turned their noses at and rebelled. That was me a couple of years. I tended to wear black on those days. But then there were others that got quite into it. It was fun. Another good memory I have, we started a tradition of cotillions. There was a member of our ward who was there for quite a while, and he knew all the Jane Austen dances, the ones that you'd see in all the Jane Austen films. And this proved to be very successful because guys, you know, they don't tend to like the whole dance thing. So if you tell them exactly what to do and how to step and where to go and when, the pressure's off a little bit and they can actually enjoy themselves. And we would stand up in lines and Winston would teach us these dances. And then it culminated in an evening where we dress the cultural hall, dress ourselves in our Edwardian or Victorian or whatever Austinian garb and had a cotillion. And it ended up being a really fun night and a tradition that went on for many years. All these things happened in the Longfellow Park Chapel, and I associate those good feelings with that building, and they are forever one memory. For many people that I came in contact with, this was a place where there was a reawakening of sorts in terms of testimony. This was a place where it was okay to be smart, to ask questions, and to have a testimony. And I think many people felt bolstered by that. We came together and nurtured one another, not only in our studies, but in our faith. When I asked one friend about his experience helping take the books from the church library out of the building as it was engulfed in flames, he said he felt his heart that had been somewhat turned away from the church for a period of time, turned back to the gospel as he took these books out and stood side by side with members of the church. He felt a change in his heart, and it reminded me of a very beautiful principle we believe in as Latter-day Saints, that there's opposition in all things, but when we take that adversity and place it on the altar, what marvelous things can come of it. What the Lord can do with our hardships is truly miraculous and beautiful, and that was one example of that. Another friend, I asked her, when you think of the Longfellow Chapel, what do you think of? And she quoted me a scripture. And the scripture found in Mosiah when Alma was gathering some of the people out of the city and forming a church by the river. And he took these people out, and in verse 30 of chapter 18 of Mosiah, it says there, "How beautiful are they to the eyes of them who there came to the knowledge of their Redeemer." And for many people, myself included, the Longfellow Park Chapel is a place where I came to the knowledge of my Redeemer in a new and wonderful and unchangeable kind of way. And I know that's been true for many of my friends. There's more I could say, but I think I'm just going to end with that. Thank you.
Well, thank you to the presenters. We have about a half hour left. I guess it's open to some who would like to add to what's been said, and if we run out of people who want to talk, we'll quit, and if we have too many, we'll stop at 12:45. But that's one that Barnard, you're first.
I was second counselor in the branch presidency to President Ira Terry, first counselor Wilbur Cox. So many memories come flooding back of our weekly branch presidency meetings. 3/4 of them were on the construction of the chapel, and the other quarter, no, it was just 1/4 on the construction of the chapel and 3/4 on personalities and how we could help each individual in the branch. I worried as President Ira Terry came each Sunday morning, forgetting to put his socks on as a typical engineer, but greeting everyone. He knew everyone's name and soon learned the history of everyone. It was the best experience to understand how he cared for people, even as he had designed the turbines at Hoover Dam and was called on to rescue telecoms, clocks in Massachusetts. Wilbur Cox with the insurance company, I saw him turn from someone who was interested in finances to one who was interested in people. And I could not have asked for a more enlightened training on understanding people and reaching people. I was in charge of Saturday work sessions, and always had the struggle, should I stay up Friday night to get my homework done so I could work all day Saturday? We worked very hard in the culminating dedication, which Claudia referred to. I was chosen as the single student to represent all the students from all of the universities. Just before President McKay gave his marvelous talk, in which he quoted much of Longfellow. And then the most powerful dedicatory prayer that I've ever heard. It was a privilege to work on building the Longfellow Chapel structure with so many volunteers. I thank God for the people who worked to make that spiritual edifice that reached to the heavens in the name of Jesus Christ.
Amen.
Amen.
You can come to the podium if we're
well, as a pre-Cambridge Chapel Cambridgian, I've always resented the Cambridge Chapel. I was arrived in Cambridge at the time when you walked up Brattle Street and there were two elegant mansions standing opposite the Longfellow House, which were owned by the church, and that's where I first sank my roots down and felt at home in Cambridge. One of the buildings was really a hulk. It was had no beauty or finesse or grace about it, and I didn't mind when it had to go. It made room for the chapel. But the building next to it, right on Longfellow Park, was a gorgeous mansion. Mansion is defined by having a back staircase and a front staircase. And the front staircase in that beautiful building was something to behold. Beautiful, I think it was cedar wood that had, with a beautiful balustrade going up the steps. And great, beautiful front room where the mutual met and where we got to know the mission president. And I, as Claudia said, I got to know the mission president before I was called on mission there, and the mission president's wife always called me by my first name. I never was elder to her. And that building, to make room for the chapel, it was sort of an L-shaped building. They sawed right down through one chunk of that building, lifted these two parts up, and gradually moved them around the corner on an occasion when they're right out there and fully exposed, near to a hurricane hit New England that time. It was lashing the canvas that covered the sawed-off end of the building, and moved it around the corner, where it had a honorable life thereafter, but had lost its premier position. So for that reason, I felt uneasy about all these changes. And then the Cambridge Chapel was a marvelous place, but it was not an architectural marvel. The front side that you saw in the picture, looking across Longfellow Park from the Quakers across the way, was an attempt to sort of recover the a New England chapel and to sort of have a New England chapel facade and a Mormon heart inside. And that was perfectly acceptable. But the side that went along gorgeous Brattle Street was just a brick wall. The neighbors referred to it as the gymnasium. And it really, in a way, was a desecration of that great street. But I came to see that intrusion as sort of an emblem of all of us who went to church there. especially if we came from the West. I came from Portland, Oregon. Claudia came from San Francisco. Because we all didn't quite fit in Cambridge. We were doing our work there, our graduate work, our undergraduate work. We were studying, walking across the Harvard Yard or the MIT campus. The Mormons looked like everyone else. But we were still a little bit strange. We didn't quite fit. I've told this story a million times, many have heard of it, that during my sophomore year I was doing history of science as my undergraduate major, and my tutor was a very distinguished historian of science, I.B. Cohen, and while we were he said, "I'll take you on as a tutee if you'll read what I'm reading." So he would say what he was reading, then I would come in and talk to him. And he took kind of an avuncular interest in me, and at one point he said, "You know, there are people around here who think that Mormonism is garbage." And I realized he was trying to kindly bring me along so that I'd outgrow this sort of childish religion that I happened to be born into. And that sort of symbolized the fact that I didn't quite belong there. And I can't believe I was the only one who felt that way. Not that I didn't love it. I loved Cambridge more than any place I'd ever lived. I felt more at home at Harvard than any other place I'd ever been. But I knew that I was a little bit strange. Well, the Cambridge Chapel was the place where these strangers in Cambridge gathered to talk about what it meant to be a Mormon in an alien land. And it was there that I sort of knit together these two portions of my life, the scholarship that enthralled me in Cambridge and this Mormon religion, which was the very heart drive of my personal identity and my hopes for myself. And I can't believe I'm alone at having enjoyed those years where there were comrades in this same quest to join together those two kinds of life.
I don't like to put my back to the audience, so it's okay. We were only in Cambridge for 1 year, but I just feel like in that year we made lifelong friends that are just very dear to us. And I remember the first Sunday we were there, and we had two little toddlers, and Jean, who would be going to MIT for the Air Force to learn to be a meteorologist, if you can imagine. but this was before he changed his major, and he was colorblind, so he couldn't fly. So we'd come to the chapel, and I was up in the cry room with our two young ones, Jean had to report to the base in New York, and I really wanted to go with him. It was all a new place and everything, but I knew it would be hard to take our littlest one. I don't know if you remember Alice Karras, but she was on the floor, sitting on the floor, playing with the kids in the cry room. And she was just having such a great time with them and seemed to handle them so well. And I went up to her, a total stranger, and I said, "Would you mind taking my little girl for a few days?" And she did. And it was a wonderful experience, so I was able to do that. And then the trading babysitting so that we could do things with couples in the ward there. But I remember, was it John Schreiner that was at the Oregon? Oh gosh, you know, it was really a choice place to hear that music. And also, who was the other organist? He was a psychiatrist. Yeah, and he'd go in there and he'd just be playing away. But it was a place that we all gathered and all, you know, most of us had these common interests and were working hard in school and that sort of thing. So wonderful, wonderful friendships developed there, and great teachers. I remember Laurel Ulrich was teaching religious society, and she was going to school at the same time. I just was just amazed at her and others who were doing that. So short time there, but some wonderful memories and wonderful friends.
I too tend to remember the people and the feeling of someone coming from the West, as the Bushmans did, wondering if he really belonged in Cambridge amongst all these erudite scholars that must be surrounding me, not only in law school, but in priesthood meeting. But soon that kind of went by the wayside, and we realized that we all had one thing in common, which was the gospel and various interpretations of it. It was in priesthood meeting there in Cambridge that I learned for the first time that C.S. Lewis apparently was a Mormon. There were a lot of people that we were awed by their current renown, such as Elder Packer, that was our mission president, but far more who you wondered at the time, because you recognized what great people they were, what sort of renown they would have in the future, such as Richard Bushman, and our bishop, and Claudia, his wife. And it was just kind of fun to think about that. I was one who did believe that the cultural hall was a basketball court, and so a lot of my memories relate to that. And our, one year in particular, we had an amazing group of quite good basketball players. There was Nolan Archibald, who has gone on to become CEO of Black & Decker. Steve Nadal, as many of you know, done many things that make me just pant to think about it. We had Richard Iyer, who with his wife, these are all tall guys, not Nadal, but Nadal was our guard. And so we decided at some point that we were good enough that we would, well, we were good enough to win the New England Championship. And so we took a trip down to New York City to play in the regional championships there. And that was exciting. I remember, I think actually Sister Packer drove us down, some of us. And then we won that. And then there was going to be for the whole eastern part of the United States, we could play for the championship there in Washington, D.C. So we drove down, and sure enough, we ended up winning there as well. Well, for people as competitive, because most of us were in either the law school or the business school, and they tend to be type A personalities, we couldn't just stop there. There had to be something else. The NBA was kind of out of the question, but... There, in those days, there still was the all-church tournament in Salt Lake. It seemed like an unrealizable goal because none of us could afford the plane ride back there. But somebody got together and organized and raised funds, and people, wealthy non-student types in the area, apparently contributed. And we all, someone found some jerseys, some old jerseys that Harvard basketball team had used. And, so we all trotted into Salt Lake City with our Harvard uniforms and feeling like we were certainly kings of the world, but we soon found out that there were even better basketball players at Brigham Young University, and we lost. But that was a memorable experience for me, and many other memorable ones that I won't take time to elaborate on right now.
Hi, I'm Dawn Thurston, and my husband is the one who just spoke, and we came to the Cambridge area in 1967, and that 3-year period we were there while he was in law school as a a time of unrest in the country. I remember I was there as a spouse, so I kind of had the spouse experience of working while he went through law school, and for a while I worked as a secretary at Harvard Law School for Alan Dershowitz, which was an interesting experience. But I remember walking to work at the school in the mornings from where we lived at the time at Peabody Terrace, and finding a lot of debris on the sidewalk, windows knocked out from the demonstrations that occurred during the night from the war, the anti-war demonstrations. And his graduation was interrupted because of demonstrations. I was only 20 when I arrived there, and I'd had a year and a half of education at BYU. I had been married at 19, 3 months after I turned 19, and while I felt comfortable with that status at BYU and our student board there, when I got to Cambridge, I felt very immature, very uneducated, very unformed, and it was a time of anxiety, self-searching, some depression that spurred me on to want to do something more with my life. And so that when we ended our time there in Cambridge, I came home and I had two children by then, and enrolled at UCLA and put my kids in some daycare so I could do that, which was kind of unusual at that time for a Mormon woman to do. I, like Claudia, I became a mother there, and by that time we were living out in Newton Center, and we were dorm parents at a junior college there for single girls called Mount Ida Junior College. And after the baby was born, the Bushmans, Richard was our bishop at the time, they drove the half-hour drive out to see us to welcome the new baby and brought a little gift for us. And I mentioned that later to them, that I remembered that, and they said, well, you were one of the first, and we caught where we couldn't do that because there were so many babies born after that. They couldn't quite go all out like that to make a trek like that. The other thing, as I was looking at the picture up here of the chapel, I was trying to remember how it was configured, and there was a cry room, right, a glass-enclosed cry room, and I've never remembered that in any other chapel I've attended since. My main memory of that time, though, attending that church, was how interesting every sacrament meeting was. I've never been in a ward where we had such consistently interesting sacrament meeting talks. And so it was a wonderful time in our lives. Thanks.
Kind of like testimony meeting. if anyone else would like to say something, there's time. But not. So it's been refreshing to think about sacred places and sacred events. I personally appreciate the comments that have been made. I was not blessed to be there very long, only 2 years, but my daughter was there over 10 years in the 90s and into 2000, and she has deep, deep, deep feelings about Cambridge. It's Mecca to her. Well, okay, we'll be dismissed then. Thanks.